up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell, Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures are up 16, NASDAQ futures up 80. We're trying to get back yesterday's losses. We're up and down here. We've got the PPI coming in today. We celebrated what I consider to be a horrendous CPI number the other day, but... Evidently, some people thought it wasn't so horrendous. So, again, got to be careful on these numbers. It's not the number. It's the interpretation of the number. So, we ran up Tuesday, and now we went down some yesterday. Well, since I'm talking about it, we had the... And NASDAQ was down 87 yesterday, which is nowhere near as much as it was up on Tuesday. S&P was down 10, so not very much. Now, today we're up more than that. Do we have Professor Liu? I don't hear his dulcet tones. Lou, are you with us? Well, it looks like I'm here on my own for a second. These numbers today, again, people don't look at the PPI as much as they do the CPI. But it is, you know, it is a number. And both of them seem to be getting hotter and not less hot, which is not really what the Fed's talking about. Although I think... as I say this all the time, and I guess probably people, if you have a different point of view, you probably get tired of hearing it, but I think they're absolute lying to us. I think they're going the other way and this inflation number, and I don't think they care. And I think they feel that they can push it through the election, and that's where that is. Greg, do we have Lou anywhere, or is he not around?
Well, he's on.
There you are, Lou.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you must have muted thyself or something for a second.
Well, the last time I used Zoom, which I don't use Zoom that much anymore, but the last time I used it, I was able to mute the microphone so that you guys can't, you know, hear anything here, but I was able to hear you, and I don't know what happened. That's weird.
Well, first thing you got to do is blame Greg.
No, I don't blame Greg for anything.
Why?
Without Greg, none of this magic happens.
Well, that's true, but still, if it's not your fault, not my fault, there's only
I've been
one person
that.
There.
I don't know. So I'll unmute the microphone. That was when whoever sent me the chat message said, or the message on the screen that said, unmute your microphone. That apparently cured it. So
there you go.
Anyway, good morning, gentlemen.
How are you?
Snowy day here in Denver. Although, I mean, they're calling for like a foot of snow here in Denver. I don't see that happening. So. I'll take a deep breath, but the rest of the state is panicking up and down the Front Range. So it's one of those days.
So this is a Front Range storm and not a ski slope storm.
Yeah, this is so the weather. As I said, we talk about the weather here a lot, but the weather here is got this weird pattern where a lot of times you'll get a big moisture push coming in from the northwest. And it really drops a little bit west of us, but then all of a sudden it hits the mountains, the Rampart Range, that are just west of Denver. And it just unloads, and that's what's happening now.
Hey, one second, Luke. Greg, for some reason, we're not going out. Kevin just said the same thing.
Let me work on that.
All right, well, so keep talking, Luke.
Anyway, this push of moisture hits this Front Range, goes up high enough and then releases its moisture probably, you know, 10 to 15 miles straight west from Denver into those mountains. And so...
So from the other side than what's normal?
From the other side?
Well, it normally comes in from the west, goes up...
straight from the west.
Yeah.
So if it's coming in straight from the west, it dumps snow at, you know, the western mountains by Telluride and Durango and Rifle in that area, and then it hits the Vail and Breckenridge area and dumps more snow there, and then usually by the time it gets here, there's not that much stuff, but we're getting a flow now that that'll shut down, or that pushes out all this moisture instead of doing it west of a, you know, like 150 miles west of us, it's going 10 miles west of us. And so these little towns, I think it's Georgetown, just west of Denver on I-70, they called last night for them to get 36 inches. So
they usually, it comes up the other side, all the ski resorts, gets over to the divide, then it's dry, right? Usually.
Yeah, it dries out, it drops off. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
You may have to go skiing just so we have less snow.
Oh, that's right. I don't think Denver's going to get a giant hit. We've missed every time they've been, you know, hauling about or crying about snow. They've missed this year. So anyway, I wanted to just follow up on something you guys talked about earlier in the week. The DEI. Impact on the chip manufacturers and how our federal program can't get off the ground here because private manufacturers don't want to be hamstrung by diversity, equity, and inclusion policies that essentially impose an almost irrelevant, well, I shouldn't say almost, a totally irrelevant kind of standard. And what I wanted to talk about was what this looks like. I've counseled a number of clients putting in these kind of government ordered quota systems for race and gender and
did Supreme Court just say quotas are not right?
Well,
or are we paying attention anyway?
They did, but people are ignoring it. This is really ideologically entrenched in these systems. I don't know if you noticed or if Carl noticed when you guys were talking about it, but one of the categories of people that you're supposed to have a quota for, or that you're supposed to be, you know, putting your feelers out to hire, are so-called judicially challenged people. Or justice challenged people.
What do they mean? People out of jail?
Exactly. Convicts. People with felony convictions. People that no employer in its right mind would say, yeah, I think I want you wandering around in my workforce. In any event, when you have to put stuff like this in place, it becomes this crazy, monstrous patchwork of monitoring and tracking and make work and hoop jumping. Think of the Rooney rule in the NFL.
Yeah.
Except instead of a kind of loose coalition of people who say, okay, fine, you got to interview X number of people, you have to go out and show that you've reached out to various marketplaces to solicit people. You have to show that you have attempted to hire, for example, displaced homemakers. That's actually a category under federal law, federal affirmative action programs. You have to provide all of your promotion data at every level within the organization, and you have to show for every job that you've promoted somebody into, you have to show whether you considered African American, Hispanic, Asian, whatever. You have to show that you've made this consideration, and you have to justify it. And if you can't justify it,
Lou,
a federal agency will come in and will penalize you. It will allow the other angle on this, and another reason why companies don't want to be forced into these kinds of roles is that when you get into this kind of thing and you're bringing these monitors, like you have to have a DEI monitor in your company under this CHIP Act, when you bring these monitors and their staffs into your organization, it becomes a lawsuit factor. These folks generally are much more litigious than you know most of your employees, because their job is to find places where you can be sued. Their job is to essentially excite the workforce or aspects of the workforce into demanding, you know, more than you know what they have or what they perceive other people have. It's really a program that is a godsend to employment lawyers like me, because we look at it and say, you bring these folks in, you're gonna get sued. You're gonna have a little litigation engine running inside your company of people who are wandering around telling people, well, your rights are being violated, you should sue. And this again.
Lou, hey, can you?
Go ahead.
All right. No, I say, well, why don't we kind of go for a quick break here? We got to restart the computer and get the thing rolling. So why don't you take 1 minute off, hold that thought, and we'll be right back.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello, and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. We're trying again here. We think we have the stream running. We'll see if we do. We have Professor with us. S&P futures are up 17. The NASDAQ futures up 70, down a little bit from when we broke off. Greg is trying to get herself back together here. Lou, are you with us?
I hear you loud and clear. How me?
Hey, I know we were holding this thought from when we went off here. Lou, it's dropped as sort of a theme this week, as I went through the stuff for the CPI numbers the other day. And you go down, you see the difference between the adjusted and the unadjusted. You know, it's funny, the more I do the show, the more it's all the same subject. I see stuff like rice, you know, and somebody goes out and surveys the price of rice everywhere, literally, and it's up 0.4% or whatever it was. And all of a sudden, the adjustment is 0.1%. And I'm like, who the bleep are these people? Remember the lady being interviewed in the movie The Verdict, when she goes, I want to be a nurse, who are these people that ruined my career, or something like that?
Yes.
I'm curious as to how does this stuff, I mean, I doubt very seriously whether it's Biden or Trump or whoever the hell it is, gets down to the minutia like this. Who are the demigods that write this stuff into bills and people go, where did this come from? I mean, who are these people?
Yeah, I don't know, and this goes back to some things that, you know, you and I've talked about. I don't know that any of the people on the Republican side of the aisle who looked at this bill and said, this is a good idea, and I mean to vote for a DEI aspect of this program such that it's going to drive businesses out of here. I mean, I think any person looking at that, at those contracts, would say to themselves, this is federal money and we're going to get all these financial supports, but it's coming at too great a price. We basically are going to lose control of the ability to manage our personnel within this organization, and we're talking about a high-end competent workforce that we're going to have to hire. What this resembles, Chief, is the kind of a contract that I would negotiate on behalf of the government of Kazakhstan when I was working in former Soviet Central Asia, and we were putting contracts together for oil development in Western Kazakhstan, and the Kazakhs basically put terms into all of their contracts that required the oil companies to come in, hire X percentage of local workers, which was fine, and then effectively set up training schools for them within the company so that they could develop their own internal expertise. Now, from a national perspective, this made sense. And the fact that you were producing oil, this made sense. You were basically, this was your trade-off. But that's not the, I mean, that's not the kind of thing that a normal, you know, U.S. business would be considering. And they shouldn't have to. It's amazing to see that this kind of thing, this DEI mentality, predominates even over the ultimate goal of producing microchips or some other, you know, essential kind of product. If you're going to come in and put this in here, you have to deliberately skew your workforce towards away from what you would presumably be hiring. That is competent, you know, smart people who are going to make an immediate contribution to your ability to produce this product that we all say is so important. It's absolutely nuts. And I, again, from my perspective, it's a litigation engine. If you start doing this stuff and you start, if it comes to the fore that you are using race or gender or sexual identity as the predominant criterion for an employment decision, you're breaking the law. And I don't, I just don't understand why somebody wasn't standing up on the Senate floor screaming.
But you slipped in the part about Republican side of the aisle. I used to be a Democrat. This makes no sense to anybody. I mean, I can't believe Dick Durbin reads this and goes, it's a good idea.
This this goes to something we've talked about before as well. These people are ideologues, Tom. That's why it makes sense to them. This ideology of the entire country is a racist hellhole, and therefore we have to force people to hire African Americans, Hispanics, non-white people, BIPOC, you know, the category. We have to force people to hire these folks, because otherwise they would never do so on their own, regardless of merit or competence or skill. And it's ridiculous.
Well, there's also kind of another theme that's been kind of percolating, you know, because we have different people every day, and the same little things keep popping up. Well, and I know I'm leading the charge from our industry, and I don't really have an issue with some sort of common sense stuff in terms of what PTI Securities or Lakeside Bank or some common sense stuff to not let essentially criminals open up accounts. But when it comes to the point where, okay, they want us to check, you know, Interpol, they want us to check this, they want us to check that for any new client, you know, I guess we can do that, you know, because whatever, and we do, by the way. Still doesn't mean that if the person is a crook anyway and Interpol didn't happen to find them, it's all of a sudden it's our fault, not Interpol's. I mean, somehow or another, there's a shift in... I don't really have a problem, Lou, with a, shall we say, county jail having an educational job reach-out program where people coming out of county jail might have a chance to actually get a job and not go back. I'd be all supportive of that. That's the government's job. That's what we're paying these people for. That is not to say that PTI Securities, out of the next 10 people we hire, 3 of them have to come out of county jail. That's not it. If somebody comes out of there qualified and blah, 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 I think we'd probably be happy to hire somebody. But it's not our job to do that, I don't think, is it?
It is if you are going to accept government money.
What I'm saying, it doesn't mean I become a policeman. They can say all they want. Sorry. I'm just not me.
I know. This has been going on in federal contracting circles for decades, since the early 70s.
Lightly, not to this extent.
Well, no. If you were a federal contractor, you had to sign on and set up an internal affirmative action plan that allowed something called the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs to come in with no warning and basically say, I want to look at your records, I want to look at your hiring records, I want to look at your outreach records, it doesn't work for every federal contract. It has to be above a certain threshold, but it's a low threshold. And I did a number of these audits where the company was blindsided. In comes the OFCCP inspector. She says, I want to see your hiring records, your promotion records, and oh, by the way, how you classify jobs doesn't matter. We're going to classify your jobs for you. Because, you know, if you tell us, for example, that an executive assistant who's a white female is making more than an administrative staffer who's African American, we think those two jobs are the same. And the employer goes, no, they're not. They require different skill sets and different, different educational backgrounds. The government inspector will say, no, I don't agree with you. I think those are the same job for purposes of comparison, and you should be paying those people the same. This is the level of intrusiveness that a number of federal contractors have been living with for some time, and it's being pushed out now as part of this DEI madness. And you're right, it runs afoul of what the Supreme Court has said, but American, the ideologues that are involved in this, and a lot of American businesses have this kind of mentality at the top level, have learned that they can safely ignore the Supreme Court until they get into litigation.
How much of this, I have a quick story to tell you about way back in the day that you'll laugh at. How much of this is just the people is reflection is becoming in government? I mean, Lou, all you have to do is drive around or walk around and you realize we have a population. I don't care if they're white yuppies, if they're black, whatever they are. They don't think the laws are for them at all. I mean, it doesn't surprise me that people ignore the Supreme Court. They ignore every stop sign, ignore every red light. Is this just what we've become? I mean, why would I be stunned if people in government actually would pay attention to the Supreme Court when I walk down the street and nobody pays attention to anything?
I will tell you that this is an aspect of, this is one of the reasons why the education system is, and dealing with it is so important, because you are basically working for a population, working to get a population of people who are or have this kind of indoctrination, and are told that, you know, you don't have to listen to the Supreme Court or any of these folks, because they are ideologically riddled with racism, sexism, what have you.
I think it's more you do what you damn well please, and you become a moral relativist. It's all on you. If I don't think there should be a stoplight there, I don't stop for it.
I would love to think that that's the reason, but I don't think it is.
Time for 30 seconds for a quick story regarding this. You're right. It's been there forever, because I was, I'm going to say, two or three rebuilds of the Dan Ryan Expressway ago when I was in, I must have been like a freshman in college, Luke. They were hiring people. Those days they did it 24/7, right? When they fixed their expressway, they didn't work 8 hours with 10 guys with some huge contract. But anyway, so it was gonna be 24/7, so they were hiring all kinds of people. So my buddy and I went and sat there at the hiring place probably 5 hours 4 days in a row. So I got involved with a couple of the guys, and this black guy I became friendly with, and it turns out he had a family, a job, and I'm sitting there, well, this guy needs a job more than me, you know. And they had these minority hiring quotas, which, again, I didn't have that much of a problem with. It's on the south side of Chicago. It's going through black neighborhoods. There should be some black guys there. And principal. Plus, it's a laborer job. You know, we're not talking about. But it was $9-$10 an hour. It's big dough back then. We're talking 71, 72. So I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, they never hired. They never hired. Come back tomorrow. Finally, this one black guy's telling me, oh, don't worry, I'm in. What do you mean you're in? Well, because I'm a member of this coalition, this community organizer guy. Okay, how exactly does that work? He goes, well, he's going to get $2 an hour off my rate. So if I make a $9, I got to give him $2. So sure enough, on Monday, everybody's already hired. And I go, how the hell were they hired? I was here Saturday, so I come back Monday. They had a special meeting on Sunday night, which they only told a few people about. All these guys showed up, and they all got hired. And in the mix was some ass who's got his thumb in this pie taking the money from these guys. So it had nothing to do with being, you know, racially something something. It had to do with this black community organizer getting $2 or $1.50 off everybody's wage.
That's part of this.
I guess my question is, who makes money on this? This is feathering somebody. I mean, somebody's making dough off this. Who is it?
You can call them race grifters or whatever. It's the racial grievance industry, and it's big and it's growing, and it's got a line into almost every federal agency, and probably most state agencies in Illinois. But it's got its hands in there, almost every federal agency now. So
whoever it is.
Well, what do you mean it?
I'm
referring to the ideology.
I know, but there's somebody. When I ran for the CBO, this guy Larry Bloom, who had been involved in the building and everything, knew everything about the whole bit, was the original kind of board members and everything. He says to me, I'll support you for the board. You got to do me one favor. And I go, what's that? He goes, if you can find out, you got to tell me who actually is really running the CBO. There's been a man behind the curtain since day one. I can't figure out who it is. And you know what? I felt there was too. I never could figure out who it was. Who's the man behind the curtain? I mean, there's votes there, but are there that many? I mean, I don't know. I mean,
apparently there are.
I don't know. I don't.
Let me shift gears.
All right.
To this Gaza doc, which you and I have been sort of discussing on email over the last week.
Is going to take 7 days to get there, or 10, right?
Well, that's right. I listened to a very interesting discussion among a couple of Israeli journalists the other day. And here, let me give you this backstory, and if you've talked about this already, let me know. It appears that the Israelis have been pushing for this for some time, that they have been asking for assistance in setting up some kind of maritime delivery for relief into the strip, because the Israelis are looking around trying to figure out how they can begin to administer this region, because they have no intention of turning it back to the Palestinians, not in any time soon, but they have to administer basic services, and the problem has been that anytime you try to install any kind of basic service operation in Gaza, a bunch of guys with guns show up at your doorstep and say, we're going to take it from here, and it falls apart. So the Israelis have been looking to set this up, some kind of mechanism to set this up, and they've actually been asking for the ability to do some kind of maritime delivery of relief.
Right, I'm assuming there's not even a horse bleep port anywhere in Gaza.
Well, and they know that.
Yeah, but there isn't one. There's not one.
This is why we come in. So the rationale for that, as I said, the Israelis, one, know they have to administer the place. And so if aid is delivered via their port, their guys have guns. They can control the distribution. And frankly, they can, as people come to collect this food, they can start calling out the bad guys. You know, they can start using facial recognition and spotting, you know, guys and pulling them out. So they've got control over that. And they, frankly, Chief, also can tell the civilian population, if you want more aid, you want more food, turn over the bad guys in your midst. So that's one. Here's number two. Most of the stuff that's coming into Gaza right now, the humanitarian aid, is coming in, and supplies for Hamas are coming in through Rafah, through the tunnels under Rafah. And if the Israelis establish an alternate supply route, this allows them to, in full good conscience, go into Rafah, level the place, and get to those tunnels. And the Egyptians, according to these two Israeli journalists, Egypt is hugely complicit in sending arms, food, military supplies to Hamas through these what they think are very large underground tunnels operating under the border there, and the Israelis are going to find them when they go into Rafah. You know, they can't disassemble those tunnels, so now the Israelis can go in, blow those tunnels, and expose Egypt for the Egypt operation for what it is. Go in, destroy those tunnels, and they now will have an alternate way of getting supplies in to this population without having to worry about what else is coming in underneath the border. So this thing works to their advantage in a couple of strategic ways. Now, you and I look at it from the perspective of, A, the president lied. He said there are going to be no boots on the ground.
I told you how they're going to do that.
Because it's impossible. Yeah, they're going to wade in. They're going to be in 6 inches of water.
Yeah, and they're going to hand it off. It's simple.
Yeah. That's a lie.
You ever heard of high tide, low tide?
Sure.
Okay.
That's a lie, and we know that's a lie. We look at it from the perspective of exposing our troops to all kinds of potential risks. But from the Israeli perspective, you know, this could easily be a very effective joint operation, and if they provide security, you know, this may get pulled off with a minimal loss of American life. Now, we're buying all this stuff, we're supplying all this stuff, although I did see a report on Twitter by some Gazan nitwit who was holding up a humanitarian, you know, one of those humanitarian ration kits and saying this stuff expired, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
Must have come from the Russians.
Well, no, it came from us. Yeah. But it, you know, we don't put expiration dates on our rations because, especially the humanitarian ones, which have no meat in them, they tend to have a shelf life of almost forever. What's on the package is the manufacture date, and that tells you, if you look at the ration, that tells you how old it is.
Well, we have expiration dates on vinegar now, for God's sake.
We don't have expiration dates on our mill rats. I carry one in my backpack.
Hey, you know what we have expiration dates on that I found out yesterday? If you buy a ticket for the CTA.
Yes.
And that's scary.
Yep. And totally crazy. Same in the metro in D.C.
Greg is too young. Remember when, if you wanted your biggest hedge against inflation, if you thought stuff was going up, you went out and bought like about 1,000 subway tokens for New York because they would always be good?
Yes. Yeah.
Can't do that anymore, I don't think.
Can't do it. Nope. Anyway,
I have such mixed feelings about this whole operation over there, Lou, because I have never liked Netanyahu. Ever, ever, ever. And the day this is over, the guy gets voted out. So it's never going to be over, in my opinion.
That's a real, you know, potential. It's totally crazy that this is being done without any kind of debate. You know, this you and I have lived through, you know, the shades of Da Nang.
Yeah.
You know, when in 1963 and 1964 we started moving, you know, equipment in to support South Vietnam, and the first thing that happened was we put the guys offshore moving the stuff in. And as they moved the stuff onto shore, they were attacked.
We needed advisors.
That's right. Then we had to put troops. Then we had to put troops in to protect the guys that were moving.
First it was advisors. Then we had to protect the advisors, right?
We had to protect advisors. Okay. This is a slippery slope, and again, done with no debate, with no response, with no challenge, and I'm, you know, maybe it's impossible for an American politician to stand up and say, look, here's the deal. I support Israel. I support them unreservedly. I don't care if Gaza gets bulldozed down to dirt. I don't care if the Israelis feel it for their self-defense that they have to take the entire female population of Gaza and sell them into the slave markets of Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. You know, I don't care. This whole thing was open because of Hamas. They don't get to dictate how, and we don't either, how the Israelis have to respond. They have to eliminate a threat. But apparently, nobody's willing to stand up and say that.
There are degrees of all this stuff, Lou. And you know, I'm on opposites. Hamas was there. If it wasn't for Hamas, if it wasn't for it's sort of like what the Allies did to the other side after World War One. You didn't create Hitler, but you sure as hell created the atmosphere for
him. Well, I'm not talking about any kind of response that allows for anything other than the total elimination of the Palestinian threat to Israel. I'm not talking about letting them have their economies. I'm not talking about letting them keep Berlin. I'm saying, you, in my mind, after what happened and after the history in that region, you have a homicidal element, you know, millions of people who have a homicidal intent toward your country. You are justified in doing whatever it takes to eliminate that.
Okay, but there are people who feel, I mean, I'm not going to ever justify what Hamas did, okay? But when you've got 1,000 people went and did some really awful stuff, it doesn't make every Palestinian subhuman and just a bump in the road for your bulldozer. It doesn't do that to me. I can't go there.
Okay. Well, based on what I know of the history and based on what I know of the culture, that's effectively what Israel is fighting. And so I, you know, my response is, you guys go, do your thing.
There's reasons why
this is not
people
this is
dislike.
No, my point is, this is no longer a matter of deterrence. Okay, the deterrence doesn't work. It's been proven over and over.
Okay,
again.
But you have areas that are, you know, I mean, as you know, I'm a little more economically driven on this than, you know, you and Mike are clearly coming from the defense side, and there's no way on earth that when you've had people in places like Gaza and the West Bank in refugee camps for three generations, that you're
not refugees if they're because they've been in one place.
Okay,
they don't have refugees for three generations. They live there.
Okay,
they're residents.
The
refugee thing is an UNRWA idiotic designation.
I'm saying people were displaced during wars a generation ago.
People were displaced all over the Middle East,
right,
after the Second World War.
No, I'm talking about after the Second World War, after a couple of... Anyway, we should talk about this when we have some more time, but you can't say, what's the thing? The beatings will continue till the attitude improves? You can't do that, Will.
Well, effectively, you can. And this takes a hard line.
I'm never going to agree with the idea that we should kill every single Palestinian just because there might be a Hamas guy in there. I can't go there.
I'm not saying they need to do that. I'm saying
on their way.
No, they're not. If they were, the casualties would be 100 times higher.
Oh, okay, but I'm saying we could have, I guess, in Gulf War One, somebody could have justified us tearing the whole place apart and killing another million people. We didn't do it. That's just us.
No, because we were believing that a political solution was still possible.
These stresses need to be dealt with somehow. You can't have areas where 45%
I agree, but the way to deal, and I'll let you go at this, the way to deal with the stress, this particular stress, is the elimination of this particular culture.
You can't, eliminating everybody who voted for a dissident group because the dissident group ended up, there's reasons why they have dissident groups there. The place is a hellhole. There's nobody has a job. They got nothing. There's reasons why. I'm not saying that ever is a justification for going and killing people and raping them. It sure as hell isn't. But you got to expect that's what happens, Lou. I mean, right? I mean, you got to find a way to deal with it. We're going through the exact same thing here in some of these neighborhoods where nobody has a job, nobody has any education, and it's the same problem, isn't it? Humans aren't different.
It's not the same problem.
On an individual level, it's the same problem.
But it requires, I think, a national culture change.
Well, sure it does. I mean,
and it's only going to, and we've proved that's only going to happen by force.
Did we continue to kill every single German until we rousted out the last Nazi? We could have, I guess. Voted for him.
That's pretty much what happened. We took the country over for what, 7 years? We let them have government back in 53.
Okay, but we stopped killing them. Anyway, we'll talk about this next week. But I don't know what's going to go on with this idea of you got to training people, trying to make the best you can out of the society, and doing the best for people who have been in jail and so forth. I'm all for that, too, but I can't ever hire the person who's not qualified or the person who is. I just can't go there. I'm in the same spot in here you are.
You're part of the system. You're part of the problem, man. And with that, I'm going to let you go.
Without doubt, I'm an old white guy. I'm absolutely. I didn't even realize how racist I was, and I never have been. Anyway, SB Futures up 18. NASDAQ Futures up 77. Be right back.
You know, guns don't kill people. Stupid motherfuckers with guns kill people.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Hello, Northbound Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. Greg Pappas on the board. We finally got everything all straightened out here. We had a little bit of a blip, but Greg fixed it. This Greg guy's pretty good. You know, don't let what he says and the fact that he keeps trying.
It wouldn't happen in the first place. So,
say that, but it's better than you know what? Everything happens. Sometimes you get a flat tire, you change the tire. This is just the way it runs here. Anyway, S&P futures are up 17.50, NASDAQ futures up 76. We have Mr. Dan Janitas.
We do.
Hey, Dan, yes. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
All right. You managed to, your spot. You managed to dodge all the issues. We had to take Lou off for a second while we reset everything, but then Greg got it all fixed. But Lou was talking about the amount of these companies now that are just kind of refusing these big government aids packages because of all the stuff that goes with it. I'm not so sure that's so good, is it?
No.
I mean, what are we doing here? Hey, I sent Dan, one of our listeners, been a listener forever, sent me this thing, and I, you know, you learn from everybody, right? And it's, if you stop doing that, I think you kind of, whatever, it's not a good thing. But if you look at the debt numbers here, and one thing I've not zeroed in on, all sector debt is now God knows how much. We're into how many billions of trillions of dollars here, everywhere, and it just continues to rocket up here. We talked about consumer debt last week, and we didn't even talk about the auto loan debt then. And a lot of this, whenever you talk about, and I know in the back of your mind, without popping myself into your head, you're looking at some of the risks out there, and you've told us five times now, or at least, hey, the risk in this other stuff is not worth the 2% more you're getting from T-bills.
Right.
And but what I, you know, what I didn't focus on though is the debt. The total debt is according to this guy, we have $98 trillion of debt everywhere, right? But you know what I didn't think of? The debt payment now for all concerned. He says this listener talked about $5 trillion each year. Well, that's at 5%. What if inflation keeps going and the number becomes 8 or 10, are we going to sink this whole ship into the Atlantic, or what are we going to do?
It's amazing how quickly it's grown. And if you go back, and, you know, I was looking over at over the chart since basically the 50s, 60s, where things were relatively flat, right, during that period. And then our level of debt increased, you know, pretty precipitously over the years. It's interesting. I think if for the listeners, I think the analogy is thinking about credit card debt, right?
Yeah.
So as you were saying last week, talking about consumer debt, the government has this debt too. And one other thing I want to say is just the very basic definition. If you think of debt, debt is the amount of money that is owed to others. So the government, our federal government, owes $98 trillion to other people. As an individual, you owe whatever your credit card debt is to the you know, whoever the
man, the man.
Exactly. So the man. So, and I want to make one distinction between debt and deficit, because we hear those words a lot. Deficit is the amount of, it's where costs exceed income. It's where liabilities exceed assets. Now, the federal deficit is where spending exceeds revenues. So this is the distinction between debt and deficit. But you're right. I mean, when the amount of debt goes up, it has to be paid off. And it's not going to be paid off at the rate, you know, the new money that's coming in is not going to cover those $5 trillion dollars in payments each year. So how does it get paid off? Well, it doesn't get paid off, and that $98 trillion continues to increase. And the consequences would be similar to the consequences of an individual who has credit card debt that just keeps growing and growing and growing. And you're right, Chief, if the interest rates go higher, that puts more burden on the what I would refer to as the issuer or the borrower of the debt, in this case being the government. So yes, this is a real issue. It's an issue that tends to not be discussed as much as it should. I think it's a concern that we should all have. And also we're kind of just waiting to see when is this going to hit the fan, you know, because at some point it will, and it will start having an impact just as it would with an individual, right, whose credit card debt has increased. So lower rates will help that. We are still anticipating that we're going to see lower rates in the future, but the pace of rate cuts is definitely declining. We're not going to see the rate cuts that were anticipated for this year, especially with the news that we just got on the CPI on Tuesday.
That number was horrible when we rallied.
Yes, exactly. good point. So I think the point is, you know, the general point is that we're, you know, we still see increases, and we're seeing increases in gas prices. We're seeing increases in car insurance, airfare, used cars. And this has a negative impact on our economy. This is something that is going to continue to impact both the consumer, corporations, and the federal government. So there's the benefit, I guess, is if you're able to save, you know, I try to take the other point of view as a portfolio manager and investor, that take advantage of the higher rates to invest your money. But for those people who are the borrowers, the issuers of the debt, it's tough. And that means the federal government, that means individuals with credit card debt, and that means corporations that have issued debt as well. So this is going to take some time to play itself out. The longer we remain at higher rates, the worse it's going to be for the federal deficit, the worse it's going to be for the federal level of debt, the worse it's going to be for the individual level of debt and for corporate debt. Of those three groups, household, corporate, and government, corporate is actually doing the best. Corporations had issued a lot of debt, and being a high yield manager for so many years, we saw in the late 80s the amount of debt that the corporations were taking on, and it got to a point where it became easier for corporations. Mike Milken in the junk bond world made it easier for corporations to issue debt.
He made it easier for mid-level and smaller level. The big guys never participated in that.
Right, exactly. And But during that period, that the, you know, we saw a lot of businesses grow through leverage, and then we saw the consequences of that starting in the early 90s when a lot of these companies went into Chapter 11. They went into, you know, we went through this bankruptcy period. Ever since then, corporations have really paid more attention to their balance sheet. So their level of debt has not increased at the same pace that it was increasing back in the late 80s.
So, you know what, Dana, we used to have a guy on the show that tracked this. And I think in the last 4 or 5 years when the rates got down so low, I think some people, but who the hell was it? I don't want to use the name, but we used to have somebody on the show who used to track this. And he was convinced that the amount of stock buybacks had essentially taken balance sheets that were in spectacular shape, say 10 years ago, and in the 5 years, you know, he was tracking it and he was here, they actually had gotten worse and worse, because they'd used if the choice was to pay down debt or to buy back stock, he always bought back stock. And it virtually, I mean, you could have made again, this is before COVID has thrown everything so off the walls. I read some article in, say, 2020, right before COVID, that in the last 10 years, something like 80 or 90%, again, this is going fading memory, some 80 or 90% of new money in the market came from corporations buying their own stock back. It could have been debt retired.
It could have been, right.
And I mean, United Airlines is a perfect example of that. I mean, we were in trouble in 9/11, and then, yep. And then all of a sudden they got the problems in 2007, and then they had problems in COVID, and they're you know, up shit creek again, right? Well, because all they did was buy stock back, and they never bought a plane. Three things. One is, many, many years ago, when I was in class and Milton Friedman got the question, I remember like it was yesterday, said, what do you have a problem with national debt? And he goes, I don't even worry about it. And somebody said, well, why is that? And he said, well, it's like you owing your wife money. He goes, the household's flat. He said, if the government borrows money from their population, the country's flat. But he didn't anticipate, I don't think, all this money being other places. Now, I just got three things I'll roll at, and you can comment as you wish. The other is, when debt starts to grow, it can just grow normally. It can grow with the population. It can grow with the economy to the point where, if it's the same level, maybe you don't even worry about it all that much. Okay. Matter of fact, if you and I had 5 or 6 hot dog stands that were doing extremely well, and we had them all paid off, probably we would leak a little leverage out for the next stand, saying, "Hey, look, let's just borrow the money, because if we're returning more on it, we're actually going to return better." You know, there is some correct level of debt versus equity that maximizes your equity. Right now, obviously, that can change, but there's also two things that are really weirdly important on this, in my mind, is we look at these interest rates right now. I look at if these guys keep throwing more money into the system, which they're doing, and all of a sudden everybody kind of wakes up someday, and this can happen immediately because it did back in those days. If we run from 4.5% to like 9% on these 10-year rates, what is this? All of a sudden, the debt service, they don't think that can happen. It can happen. And the other thing, Dan, and this is the one I'm really concerned about, and I would love you to talk me down on this one. When you and I or somebody has some debt, whatever it is, we have a car, we pay for it, all of a sudden we get in some kind of trouble, and now we're borrowing the credit card to make the car payment. All of a sudden this goes, I could use today's term and say it goes viral, but it starts to go vertical to the point where I sense that's happening here. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong, and it's actually, you know, and I think the point that you made as well about, you know, we went through this period where there was refinancing when rates were low. And I think we have to have a certain amount of memory. Sometimes people forget that you know, you have to go back many years when you and I were around to remember that period where rates were much higher. But in the, you know, there was a good decade, a good 12 to 15 years where we had low rates, a lot of refinancing, a lot of paying off. debt. Now that we're in a period of higher rates, there's no question that we're, you know, both the individual and the government and to a lesser degree corporations are much more challenged right now. There's absolutely no question that that's the situation we're in. So going forward, there is a lot of risk to just this trend continuing. And with what we're seeing now, especially with the news on Tuesday that inflation rate is high, we're seeing that rates are going to remain high. So the, you know, just as an individual has the option of filing Chapter 11, just as companies have the option of filing bankruptcy, we have to still be cognizant of the fact that the government could be in that same situation too at a certain point.
Well, that's what we were talking about yesterday. Here, Dan, how come you and I, we obviously we talk, I don't know why my focus is so much different than everybody. When we talk about rates, everybody, you included, although I know you have much more depth to this, we talk about how the Fed has gone from 0 to 5.5, and it's 90% of the conversation. Yet I don't look at that. I look at that 10% of it. I look at the 10 and 30 year going, this inflation's going to be 5 or 6% going forward. It sure as hell looks like it is. That number's going to be 9. And it's going to happen one of these, all of a sudden. It's going to be like, what does Kevin say? Very gradually, then all of a sudden. One of these days, that rate is not going to be 4 when the short-term rate is 5.5. It's not going to, that's what I'm worried about. How come nobody seems to have a worry about that at all? Am I just a knucklehead out in the middle of the ocean or what?
No, absolutely not. In fact, your view point is actually happening this week. You know, when we're seeing inflation at a higher rate than anticipated, and I do agree with you that as you know, because the money, you know, because the money that's been pouring into our system, because so much money was poured into our system from the cut in corporate taxes, from the COVID money and all that, from you know, the huge inflation we've seen in both the stock market, which is breaking new highs, as well as housing, it's that trend is not likely to stop, which means, as you're saying, that the rate is could potentially be quite higher than it actually is. And we're talking about rate cuts again. I think everyone, especially the talking heads on a lot of the financial shows, are really just looking at the short term, and they're just looking at what basically whatever the talk is. If everybody's saying it, then they're going to say it. We're going to see it. And that's kind of where I think we get lost, is in looking just at the short term. But we have to look at the long term, and I think that's what you're doing, which is very wise, because there is going to be a long term effect. And when it happens, when we get hit, when this becomes a more important issue, we don't know. But right now, I agree with you, people aren't paying attention to that. And we should be, because this is not the early stages, we're probably already in the middle stages of seeing this issue become potentially really bad for our economy and the financial markets at some point. So I think it's good to have this thought and to think about it. People will sort of say, think of the analogy, Chief, that people will say, well, you know, I'm doing okay right now, even though I have all this credit card debt, I can still like go out and buy a new car and just keep adding to it. At some point that you can't keep doing that. And that payment that you're gonna owe is gonna only increase. Rates are somewhat artificial, but we look at the real rate. The real rate has absolutely increased over the last year and a half, last 2 years. So that does have an impact. And, you know, again, memory is, you know, people's memories aren't really that, you know, they're just thinking about what we've been through the last 10 or 15 years, not thinking about, you know, the period of the early 80s or, you know, at a time when rates were much higher. So I would agree with you and definitely see your viewpoint on this. You know, I think the optimist to me sees rate cuts, which will obviously help bonds and stocks. So that's where the optimism comes in.
Simple, not to be argumentative, but I love being argumentative because you always have a good answer. Why does 99% of the investment world think that a rate cut will be good for stocks when every single rate increase has had the market go up?
That's a really good point. Again, because think of it as what I just said. Think of the individual, which I think a lot of the listeners can relate to, is the individual who continues to, you know, rates can be going up, and you can just throw those extra purchases on your credit card. So, and that's in effect what's happening with the federal government right now as well.
But if the world was as you and I think it ought to be defined, or traditionally has been defined, if rates go from 0.5% or zero to 5.5%, and your market sold off 20%, there's no question that the logic would be the minute we go the other way, the market is going to rally back and regain whatever it lost. Yet that's not what happened.
Right, it isn't. Yeah, absolutely. That's just not the way it is. And same thing when you lose money in the equity market, in the stock market too, right?
Yeah.
So it's the same concept. One thing that I'll do though to turn my optimism around here, and again I'm on the same page with you with the debt, the concerns we should have about the federal debt, and we should have about credit card debt and consumer debt. But to flip it around from the investor's point of view, this is a really good period to be investing in. We've been talking about T-bills.
Yeah.
So one of the advantages, you know, glass half full way of looking at it, is that you're getting, you know, we're getting 5.5% to 6% in our cash strategy, but you're getting 5.5% on a 1 month T-bill.
Well, for the first time in almost 17 years, you're breaking even with inflation.
The glass half full.
Yeah.
It's everybody else is underwater and not beating inflation.
Yeah.
Right, but at the same time.
But we're long stocks.
At the same time, for individuals who are approaching retirement, you know, where their income is declining, they're still able to see this growth in their portfolios and their accounts.
Yes.
That they haven't been able to see in a long time with virtually no risk.
Exactly right.
And this strategy is I think it's comforting to a lot of people who are concerned, because even though you know what they're getting versus what the inflation rate is, and again we can argue on what the true inflation rate is right now, but that 5.5% is certainly higher than the 3.5%. So this is a period as an investor where you can capitalize on the higher rates, and again not thinking of it from the debtor point of view but from the creditor point of view, looking at it as an opportunity to to preserve the capital you have and actually to watch it grow, like we used to when we had our bank accounts when we were younger, and you go in, your savings account is growing. Oh, I made a little money. It felt like free money. It's not free money, yeah. But it felt like free money back then. And I'd say if you look at the, you know, right as of this morning, the 1 month T-bill at 5.52, we buy off the run T-bills that you can get 5.6, 5.7. And we do a little bit of trading.
Yeah, why does somebody, I mean, I know you're getting it, but why does somebody sell that to you like a day after they buy the thing at a different rate?
Yeah, the rates are moving pretty rapidly. And with this news and with the expectation for rate cuts or no rate cuts, they literally change day to day. And it's also a supply and demand. So there are people who are going in buying large pieces, and supply and demand does impact the treasury market and the T-bill market as well.
Oh,
so
sure. We went out Monday and we did, I think everybody was over 100 grand. We went 3 months, and everybody was under, we went 6.
Right. And one of the questions that I've received recently from several clients, and actually had several discussions this week, so what happens when rates do come down? Are we, you know, if you're in this T-bill strategy, and the answer is with any bond. And this is something that I wanted to mention going back to our initial discussion. When interest rates go down, all bond prices go up. Whether you own a municipal bond or a treasury bond or a T-bill or a corporate bond, or the prices go up. So you have that extra portion of your return in capital appreciation. The time that you have to be concerned about lower rates will be sometime down the road when lower rates become the norm, but we're not in that environment right now.
Well, you could buy if you were, I won't even say a 30-year, because that used to be the one that would trade it. You could go out and buy a 10-year right now, Dan, at 4.206 is the TNX, and if my hopefully not prediction but worry comes to the fruition, and the 10-year rates go to 8, you're talking about that bond trading for 60.
Right. You're gonna be whipsawed, and that's what happens. It's called interest rate risk. The longer the maturity, the more you're gonna be impacted by changes in rates. So when rates go up, that price goes down. So for the same reason that you're concerned about buying the 10 years, we are as well. And as a bond manager for now close to 40 years, I would say this is an environment where it really makes sense to stay short. T-bills offer a really good alternative in this environment. Again, you're having the state and local tax exemption. You get that on all treasuries, by the way, but there's going to be a point where we will shift strategy, and it could be that we shift into more into either municipal bonds for taxable accounts, or we shift more into corporates if the spreads widen out. But for right now, we're in a good place on the investment side, and from an investor's point of view, and taking advantage of these higher rates. So again, we're kind of shifting gears from the issues of debt and the government debt to how do we capitalize on this as investors? What can we do? And we can participate, and you are getting extra an extra return. And there are some clients that have enough money where they can start thinking about retirement if we were able to sustain these rates. I think they're going to be sustained for a longer period of time than what has been anticipated. So look at the upside here, and the upside is investors can make some extra money risk-free, at least for the near term. And when I say near term, 1 to 2 years.
But we've had this run-up in the GDX this week, and we have a lot of that. I'm always asking you, what do you think? Because they've been lagging the gold prices. All of a sudden, it's starting to show a little bit of energy, and we've been really like doubling up on it to the upside with like little spreads and so forth. And so far, we've been killing it for the last month in here. Gold has never been here before, but last time gold was on a high, GDX traded 44. Now I don't know if it's going to 44, but 30 still seems a little light, given the fact that there must be something. There has to be a one or two of these gold mining places that must be doing really lousy or something. There has to be a clunker in there someplace, because otherwise it should be higher, right, Dan?
Yeah, I agree. And the same thing with silver as well. And in a conversation that I was having yesterday with the client in terms of deciding if this is the time to sell. I mean, the thing about gold and silver is they seem to have a much longer cycle, and they also are not necessarily trading the way they have in the past. Based on the strength of the dollar and other factors, I think if you look historically, both of those, both gold and silver look cheap relative to the historical average. But yeah, I mean, silver was up 3.7% yesterday. The spot rate has increased. It's hard to predict, just as it's hard to predict oil prices, right? You've got different factors that are impacting those commodities, and I always say it's good to have a small piece of the metals, the golds and silvers in your portfolio. I wouldn't be loading up, but I wouldn't be dumping either right now.
I'm more concerned about, I like the gold idea, but I'm still convinced, and I'm curious to why this GDX is not moving up as fast. No, it is moving. That part's good. I just, Dan, I dug this up for us. When I say this stuff is kind of going vertical, I'm looking here at auto loan debt. And in 2020 through 2023, I mean, it's up 20%. If it's up 1 or 2 or 3 or 4% a year, I sort of get it, or even 5, which is what the inflation number meaning. The car costs 5% more, the debt, if everything else remains equal, if the debt went up, 2 or 3% a year, I could roll with it. But it's kind of not. Look at the credit card debt. I mean, it absolutely is almost a vertical line. How long can we continue, and this is a societal problem, where 1% of the country manages to borrow money at less than the real inflation rate, and the 90% or the 95% of your people you eviscerated 20%. I mean, how long can we keep doing that without like some kind of revolt or something?
Well, there will be an issue, just as there was. We were talking about the corporate debt crisis in the late 80s with junk bonds. I mean, there will be a point that that's not going to be sustainable. And it's good that we think about that now, both as portfolio managers and investors, but also as individuals who, taking on more debt. My basic philosophy with this, having been a bond manager my whole career, is keep your debt on your balance sheet, your personal balance sheet, as low as possible. Pay down in periods, because we don't know what's going to happen to interest
right.
rates. Keep it. And it's also for people who are close to retirement or retiring, who are a lot of our client, a large part of our client base. Keep paying down your debt. It's freeing. It's very freeing. It's very, I think it's, what do they say, that money doesn't make you happy, but it gives you freedom.
Yep.
So I think the lack of debt gives you a lot of freedom. I think it gives you peace of mind. And it's not something that you need to worry about as you get into retirement. So be careful about continuing to put purchases on your credit card. Really kind of weigh the decisions about how it could impact you or your beneficiaries at some point down the road.
Well, I never give, Dan, you and I don't give investment advice on the air, but I have two or three new clients now that are kind of special cases, because a couple of them have just retired and have a portfolio that's, doesn't look like somebody who's just retiring. And
exactly.
And I have somebody else where they're managing an estate for somebody. And I go, you can't lose money in an estate.
Right.
You don't want that lawsuit, for God's sake. I mean,
right.
And plus now you're not working anymore.
Right.
I'm for them, again, this is, said, let's either protect it or let's get half foot in T-bills and see where this plays out. See if you get another job, settle the estate. That's not the advice you would give every person. That's why when they come to you or me, PTI and Dan, we do things together for people. Every single person, that's when I see these commercials of this firm did this for this. No, you can't put square pegs in the round hole.
Right.
Everybody's portfolio should look different. You don't just
right.
pile into the Merrill Lynch crap. I don't think, but that's people do. What can I tell you? I mean,
yeah, no, the customization is essential, and I think the as you're mentioning, your strategy and our strategy are really the perfect place to be right now for people who are close to or moving into retirement. All of that asset growth that they've seen through their houses and their 401ks and the retirement plans and the businesses that they ran, this is time to preserve that capital. This is not time, when the stock market is all-time highs, still breaking all-time highs, to be going into the stock market again and playing the momentum. There's a lot more risk in doing that than there is in holding on to what you have and earning a little bit, which is what the combination of our two strategies does.
Dan, we'll talk at you next week, buddy. Have a nice
Sounds
weekend.
Good.
Are you? We're thundering and lightning here all night. Are you guys, what's the weather like? You all right?
We're fine. We're fine
that's,
here.
That's
so.
Why you pay up to live in Florida. What can I tell you? Talk
absolutely.
At you next week.
This is the nicest time of year.
There you go. S&P futures up 10. NASDAQ futures up. We're leaking a little. We're only up 38. But we're still up. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tim Al Greg on the board. Everything working copacetic right now. We're copacetic and smooth as silk, right?
For Greg? Now.
For now, yes. I don't say that. S&P futures up 12, NASDAQ futures up 39. We just dipped here a little bit as the PPI numbers came out. We'll get those numbers all for you in a second. Dow futures up 144. As a matter of fact, I'm going to dig up the PPI numbers right now. Why don't you traffic weather sports, because other stuff's jumping all over the place, Greg.
Good morning, everyone. We got 7:38 here in Chicago. It is 45 and rainy. High of 52 today. Thunderstorm and localized flooding both here and Phoenix, which is interesting. Phoenix 51 with a high of 62 today. That's cooler and possible hail and flooding. So bring your umbrella. Traffic inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 52 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook, 90 minutes. So that's about 20 minutes worse. There might be an accident there. I haven't seen it, but 90 is about 20 minutes worse than it normally is. Ike from Harlem to the interchange, 37 minutes. The Ryan is 35 minutes from 290, or in from 95th to 290. And Stevenson is 42 minutes, 294 to the Ryan. Sports, we got DePaul going a record 0-20 in the Big East. And
yeah, you can't do worse than that.
And that's about it.
I mean, how do you do worse than that?
They were about one, I think it was 58-57. They were down to the wire, and then that was it. They lost it, I think, the ball with 8 seconds left, and their season was over.
That's well. So I've got Brewster Price Index, according to this, came in at 0.3, but I'm looking at a PPI page, and it sure looks different than that. PPI for final demand raises 0.6 in October. Goods increase 1.2. Services advance 0.3. So I'm not so sure exactly where they got the 0.3 out of here, but this seems to be the number. They've got them up 0.9% from January 23 to January 24. I don't know if I buy that either. But anyway, do we have Mr. Flanagan? Hey, John, how are you?
Good.
We've got the goods is pretty high here, and services are down. So, the goods are the stuff that you could sort of expect coming into next month's PPI. But take these numbers together, they're not the best. But so, John, how are you? What do you make of all this? We seem it hasn't disturbed the market at all. We're still up at 13. We're up 43. We've got 10-year rates up 6 basis points. So that's not any kind of a move. I don't really see any reaction to this. Do you, Greg? Of any kind, final demand 0.6. I don't know where the TV is getting the 0.3, but anyway. So, John, in keeping with our new, or not my new plan, the latest theme is who are these people? Yesterday I had a bout with the transportation system here in Chicago.
So local? You mean as a CTA?
If you'd have followed me with a camera, you'd have had a comedy skit. It was that bad. I drop my truck off at a buddy of mine's out in Midlothian, right? So he drops me off at the Midlothian Rock Island. I'm kind of excited. I've never taken the main line of the Rock Island, so of course there's nobody there to buy a ticket from. So there's this machine, and you kick in there, and it says, you know, first of all, are you over 65? And I go, yeah. Well, you evidently need a full ID card with a color picture to prove you're over 65.
The RTA senior pass.
Oh, God. I don't know what it is. So, okay, now I'm just regular. So they're 375. So I'm supposed to come back into the city yesterday, and I want to go back out today. So what would a normally logical human being do? I buy 2 one-way tickets.
Yep.
Oh, no. Oh, no. You can't. They expire yesterday.
Yeah, they expire within hours of purchase time.
What is that all about?
Well, it used to be, remember, they were good for a year. If you bought a one-way ticket...
Why wouldn't they be good forever?
Yeah, well, at least a year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when I used to, you know, when I commuted to work, I'd buy a 10-ride ticket usually on the Metro because I didn't do the same thing every day, depending on, you know, connections at the other end. But I never had to worry about the thing expiring. I always had, you know, plenty of time to use it before I ended up giving the money back to Metra. I just discovered this with the latest, you know, the fare changes and those vending machines. I don't know about you, but if you've used the same vending machines I just did a couple weeks ago, you have to be about 3 feet tall to find out where you got to pick up the ticket at it. I mean, it's built for somebody who's half our height. So.
Yep. Well, so now, I mean, what is, why can't you buy them for 2 days? What are we talking about? This is crazy.
Well, you know, I've started using the app, which I don't really like doing because it means I have to have my phone, you know, whenever I travel anywhere on Metro, which, I don't like having my phone with me, period, walking around in the city.
Why don't you get a burner phone for that?
Well, that's a possibility, too. That's pretty painless because you get it, you know, you purchase a ticket, you download it, the conductor looks at it, you tap it, the thing scrambles, so you can't use it again. But it too has expiration times on it just as well. So
it is impossible to buy a ticket for down there one day and home the next day.
No, and of course, there's no savings in doing it either.
No.
It isn't like you get a knockoff on buying a round trip. So
then I'd have to take the CTA home, right? So I pulled...
I know what you're going to tell me, but...
Well, so last time I took the CTA, I bought an extra one, put it in my wallet, said if I ever need to get on a CTA, I won't have to go through the machine, at least I got one. Of course, I plunk it in the thing. That doesn't work because it's expired. All right, so I go to the machine and I buy one. After it didn't want to take the card two ways, I finally had to put the thing in there. So I get one. I get to the turnstile. I hit it. The turnstile's... is broken. I'm going, okay, I'll try another turnstile. Oh, no, you've already used this card. So I have to go buy another one. So now I'm on my third CTA card. I walk out on the platform just as my train is pulling out. this could have been a Three Stooges. Only have been a One Stooge. I mean, and then I get on the new subway cars, and nobody, you know, on the show knows more about railroad cars than me because I worked at Pullman. These cars are atrocious. Why? For those that don't know, CTA cars would have regular seats and people could stand, right? In New York, the seats are only flat against the walls, okay?
The longitudinal seats.
Yeah, and then they have these straps hanging from the ceiling. But there's a big difference, Jan, in one man's opinion. In Chicago, you're mostly an L, where you have... things to look at. You're driving by nice parts of the city, or maybe not so nice. So you want to be able to look out the window. You don't want to be, the only place you're looking is in somebody's behind in front of you. But now in New York, it doesn't make any difference. You're on a subway. You can't see anything anyway. But here, these cars they're not appropriate for here. You want people, when they ride the L, to be able to look out and see. Where am I wrong? Who designed these things?
It was different time when, you know, everybody used to read on the L, or the subway. I remember those days. You know, they're far behind me now. But people, you know, to some extent, they have their phones to entertain them. But you're right. It's not visually, it makes the city even look worse than it is.
So I'm sitting there, and I went to Armitage, and I'm sitting there. Why do I want to ride on this thing? If I'm going to ride, you know, up to the ballpark or something, I want to be able to look out the way. In the subway, of course, there's nothing to look at. You're at a subway. Who are these geniuses? Whatever. So anyway, what you were listening to the discussion with Dan, I assume, and it's funny, John, how, you know, Dan really is on these things. Well, I mean, we have clients here too that do interest rate stuff, so we're kind of both on the stuff. And it is interesting how even if you talk to Hal or Russell, I mean, those guys are, I'm going to say they use the term more business economists, right? And than me, especially Hal, and I'm more of a social economist because I was an arts and letters economist guy. I see what's happening here, and all I can keep thinking of is what it's doing to people. And you know, it's not. A lot of economists don't react that way. They just look at the big numbers and say it's good or it's bad or whatever it is. But the differentiation here between the classes and how these numbers are affecting them is pretty dramatic. And yet I see with this, there's absolutely no fear at all here of these long-term rates spiking up. And yet I was around when they spiked up. I don't see how, if we go back to 5% and 6% inflation, that people finally get it through their thick head that that's what it is. You're not going to lend money to people for 4. Why would you? Right. You're going to stay close to do the 5 like Dan and I have been talking about forever. But eventually, you would hope that somebody could go out and get, you know, 8% for 2 years or something. I mean, if that's what the inflation rate is. But this, and the fact that this stuff starts to turn vertical, John, I mean, I know you're not the economist business guy, but the minute you get people start borrowing to pay down other debt, all of a sudden the line starts to just shoot. And I'm starting to get the feeling that that's what's happening, and I sure as hell don't want to see that, but where am I wrong? Tell me I'm wrong.
No, you're not wrong, Tim. The thing is, and you know, this feeds into historical education, giving myself a moment that I'll talk about in a second, but the longer people are ground down in this, of course, the bigger the explosions in interest rates or caught, you know, inflation, whatever, tend to be when they occur, and people have been numbed so much because they've lived with it for so long and heard about it and think about it and worry about it. And as a result, the real concussions, when things start to go haywire, don't really register maybe the way they should if people were less, you know, beaten down by these things. And as a result, you know, the sort of normal business, you know, to be in an inflationary, you know, economy and cope as best you can with it, but you can't get enough time to pull back from it and say, why are we in this at all? I'm reading a book, and I'm about, you know, a third of the way through it. I don't know if you know this book called The Forgotten Depression by James Grant. It came out in 2014, and it's about the Depression of 1920-21 after World War One. And it's absolutely fascinating, Tim. This guy is such an elegant writer, too. But the whole thing...
Well, there was a huge one in 1890s, too, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah, 1893 was I mean, that was the cruelest, maybe, depression of all. You know, where City Hall was just taken over by people who had no home, no heat, or anything. The city, and it was a terrible, terrible winter, too. But the 1920-21 one, I didn't know anything about. You know, there's a little Wikipedia entry about it, but, you know, that's it. He's writing it in, you know, the 2006-2008 mess in his rearview mirror and comparing how that played out and, you know, to the one in 1920-21. And the evidence he gives for how terrible the 1920-21 was looks on paper. I mean, it actually puts what we're seeing today with inflationary numbers kind of, you know, there's nothing to worry about almost. It's you know, terrible, you know, concussions after the war. People came back, you know, no jobs, rents exploded, cost of everything exploded, race riots, red scares, labor disputes, you know, the government had nationalized railroads or war, but all this stuff is like a perfect storm. And you got a president at the White House who's had a stroke and isn't doing anything. And you have
didn't even tell anybody he had a stroke.
No. And the government, but you know, by and large, ground to a halt, and you have a Fed that's only, you know, 7 years since its inception. It didn't know behind from a hole in the ground either. But all this helped to cure this depression within months. And the market, when it wasn't encumbered by an administrative state or a Fed that was tweaking every damn corner of the economy here, there, whatever, trying to get this perfect balance, was just, it let the market decide how to fix this thing. And, unbelievable deflationary pressure, like 18% drop in prices, 12% unemployment. Just the numbers were horrible.
But you can have deflationary pressures in a time of growth. That was not one of them.
Right.
After the Civil War, you had deflationary pressures, but it was a serious time of growth.
Right. Right. But the thing I'm taking away from this, and I recommend the book because it's a very easy read. And it takes a lot of history into consideration, and he explains things very well and fully. But now we've got a Fed that is controls the whole show. Is the money supply, the tweaking of interest rates, the forecasting, the meetings, the drive up in the stock market accompanying these things. All this stuff is engineered in a way to constantly keep us on the edge of our seats.
Well, Jenny, it's a question. It's always, I think, a question of what numbers you look at and whether you look at individual people or not. And one of the people that, I mean, I talk about him all the time because I learned a lot from the man, Milton Friedman. He was absolutely wrong a few times, in my opinion. I mean, if you were to ask him or virtually any monetarist what was the real cause of the Great Depression economically, they would say that the Fed foolishly allowed the money supply to drop 20%, and that caused the depression. It wasn't the crash. Crash certainly was a precipitator. It wasn't the crash. And I'm going to say, on some level, their mind is, if somehow the Fed were to pump this 20% back in or not let it happen somehow on the gross number high, on the top chessboard, somehow everybody would have been all right. And if he was alive today, the first thing I would say is, hey, Milty, that's BS. That's wrong. And the reason why it's wrong, I think, John, is that if you look at the 20s, after the time you're talking about, the next 8 or 9 years, the gross numbers would show pretty much incredible growth, amazing innovation in automobiles and planes and stuff. I mean, we've probably never advanced as fast in a lot of areas as we did in the 20s. Even in the computer world, I mean, you went from barely flying a plane to the thing, 30,000 feet, for God's sake, right? I mean, and the same thing with automobiles. You went with, a crank engine to a Duesenberg, for God's sake, in like 15 years. I mean, you would never have guessed you could move that fast, right? Yet, in a Bill Miller's book, it's the entire 60-70% of the population was in a total depression, agrarian mines, everything in the entire 20s. But yet, right. the major and number, from, yeah.
Right, 26 to 29, especially.
Yeah. And but then, if you looked at the big numbers, big people, Bandeau, New York Yankees, Babe Ruth, market going up every day.
Lindbergh, yeah. Across the line, everything.
Everything. A lot of people had all kinds of dough. Most people didn't. It's very, very. If you were to look at three times in society when the top 1% or 2% totally outdistanced the rest, it would be 1929, 2007, or 2000, and right now.
Yeah.
And the other two didn't, and I sure hope these guys, to get back to the Milton Friedman thing, if Grandma Flanagan walked to the bank and all of a sudden the door hit her in the nose and broke it, and her $2,000, which is her life savings, is now gone, we're not talking about an income, a regular recession, a regular type of a business cycle. We're talking about people now, it's a balance sheet recession. Totally different than an income recession. I mean, one can lead to the other. But you could have poured money into, quote, the system in 1932 and probably would have pushed the stock market way up. But unless you found a way to get Grandma Flanagan some FDIC insurance in arrears or something where she got at least $1,000 back, you're not helping her at all, are you?
No.
And that's what we're missing this time. this time, the pouring of the money in to save the market and to save people buying ball clubs so they can get 3% interest on something. Even look at the Bears. The Bears are coming up with the latest load of crap is the Bears are going to come up with $2 billion. That family's going to come up with $2 billion? Let's say it's true, Giant. And now, which means the thing's going to cost $3.5 or $4 by the time. So let's say you and I are going to come up with the other two. Nobody is saying you're going to have to pay 6, 7, 8% on this over the next 50 years. I mean, what are the Bears assuming they're going to get this money for? They're going to get some kind of a TIF, or they're going to get some kind of a deal from the government where they're going to go out where it's considered tax-free kind of stuff, for the and it's going to they're going to pay 2.5 or 3% if they even work their way through that mentally. They're not talking about 7 or 8 that somebody else would have to pay. I mean, there's no way that you're going to build a stadium for $4 billion for a football team. If it's 8% interest, that's what your check you write every year is $320 million in interest. Do you think that dog hunts for a football team? I think not. I mean, you imagine Virginia writing a $320 million check for interest every year when the place is only making the absurd total of $200 million. Hey, Virginia, you're 120.
I want to see that photo op.
Yeah, I want to see that photo op. So I mean, I don't even you know, not so sure people are thinking right here, Jan. I mean, I just would hope that this all sort of comes together. Somehow, I think you have to find a way, even though the Supreme Court totally put this one up their ass, where they said there's no such thing as a state usury rate because you can come in from another state. I think you got to get these credit card rates down to some absurd number, to like even 18%, which, you know, it's still awful, but you can't be charging people 25 when everybody's in a hardship situation, or a lot of people are. I mean, I somehow or another, this has got to be evened up, I think.
Well, I would agree. The thing is, though, Tom, the more I think about, you know, depressions I never heard of, then the depressions you hear about all the time, the ones in my family's memory, you know, in the 30s, that I think didn't have to last as long as it did. And I think that's one of the things that the people forget about. They want to remember the way things returned to normal after the war and then a huge boom. That they don't want to think about how long they were completely ground under by the Depression.
Well, like I say, Jan, just think of it, though. Think of it as how much longer, you know, a regular recession is a business cycle recession. Economy gets a little too hot, all of a sudden, it's, you know, you overproduce, you do something, you cut back, some people get laid off for a couple of months, you work off your savings, you go get another job, you do something. Balance sheet is, the savings is gone. You can't get your money out of the bank. You lost your entire down payment on your house in 2007. Those are different. That person may never come back. How can he or she?
Well, the thing is now, Tom, we are so out of the loop when it comes to a balance sheet depression. What kind of bailout are we talking about? It's inconceivable that the people would be made whole.
Think of the risk right now, Jan, and we have to dash here pretty soon. Right? If there was a little Jan running around, or a little Jeanette, and all of a sudden they get married and are looking for a house, and the houses are $400,000, I'm going to guess they don't have 80 to put down for a down payment. So, Jan, being the guy you are, you're going to say, well, here's 40. You guys saved up. Go ahead, buy the house. You need a house. I mean, you want to have some kids, blah, blah, blah. I want you to have a life like I did, or my family did. They go ahead and do it. And all of a sudden, these housing prices, which are amazingly pushed up by, all of a sudden we have the same problem like 2007, only nowhere near as bad, and the house is now 320. Now, maybe if you live there for 25, 30 years and you get back up to 400, it's kind of no skin off your behind. But what if you get transferred and now you got to puke it out at 320? Well, the bank's happy. They get their 320 back. You've just lost A, your inheritance, and B, your savings. Now, how many years of Jan and the new wife, little Jan and the new wife, how many years of working are they going to have to go before they have that $80,000 to plunk down again? A real long time. It's not like being laid off for 6 months, right?
No. I guess my thinking after what I've read of this book by James Grant, if we didn't have a Fed or a Fed that felt like it had the kind of power it clearly does, how could we be worse
off? John, what do you say we tee this up again on Monday? We got a little more time, yeah. But S&P futures up 12, NASDAQ futures up 53. We're still up. We managed to weather the PPI number like we did the CPI number. Be back on Monday or tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.